Welcome back to World Beat. I am George Collins. We are sitting here with Javon Bird. If you ain't got caught up on the first couple segments, I'd recommend doing that. We've been having a great discussion about African spiritual practices among the diaspora. And Javon, in the last segment, we talked about the stigma that really is worldwide against a lot of these practices that we've been outlining here. But I want to talk about some of the work that you've been doing to not only break the stigma, but even just to show people the value of this education, which doesn't necessarily mean winning converts, but as someone who has attended some of the workshops you've done and the seminars, especially with youth, it's really powerful to see exactly what kind of impact this can have. I'll never forget, there was an event that I showed up at just before the world went to hell in a handbasket, right? This is like February a couple of years ago. And folks, imagine this, all right? If any of y'all worked in education, I know some of you have, you know how difficult it can be to get a room full of kids to pay attention, especially the lower you go on the age bracket. Yet I'm watching this series of speakers talking about these stories, the heritage, these old ways, all this stuff. This room is totally spellbound, man. Like there's a fire truck pull up outside. I mean, the sirens ain't blaring, but you know, the lights are going off. I don't see a single damn kid looking at that thing. I think I was the only one, right? Mm-hmm. So we mentioned in the intro, you've got a couple of different projects with this, the Hawk Foundation and Awodi Drummond as well. I'm going to start what was the genesis for these projects? Where did they come from? And what is the main mission of each of them?
The genesis is when I was in college, I recognized that, hey, this can actually heal people. Gateways for Incarcerated Youth came up to me and asked me if I can contract with them at Green Hill Detention Center for Youth. And when I went there and the boys actually were fighting before, you know, you couldn't even get them in the same room. Then after I started teaching them and working with them, they all were focused. They were all focused on learning rhythms. That's what really got me saying, okay, I need to, this is powerful. I can actually heal people with this. And so that's what got me and also made me understand that, hey, children, especially children of color, they need education that really reflects who they are. So I understood that I needed to be rooted in African epistemic, you know, frameworks, but also understand, how to translate that into a pedagogy, into a multicultural pedagogy that teachers or educators in our current, you know, here could actually implement and utilize in the classroom. So that was really the root of the Hawk Foundation, to do this research, to kind of disperse it out to these schools. We've done research projects where I've continuously worked with kids incarcerated. Now we're working with, you know, UW researchers to go ahead and really get quantifiable and qualitative data to show actually, hey, this is effective. This helps with stress reduction. This helps with this. So really bringing indigenous practices to the current epic of how we're going to be moving forward as a society.
What does that look like in practice in terms of incorporating those elements? I mean, is it just simple lesson plans? Is there a different philosophy behind it? What are the actual tools that you find are the most successful that people can implement?
Lesson plans, I definitely believe in a more participatory framework where kids are able to utilize also kinesthetic knowledge to help solve problems as well. Definitely utilizing, you know, even when we mention stories as a way to actually tell history. And a lot of it too is sometimes I will use very normative practices for education, but it's what we're studying, what we're talking about, right? So one of the segments I was working with teachers as far as teaching African American history, and you know, I mentioned, okay, rather than start with slavery, let's talk about it in the context of pre-Civil War, because we talk about America and pre-Civil War, and then we have to talk about, hey, it's not just slavery that African Americans went through, but hey, there were some who actually fought back and lived in swamps. There were some who would join the Native American tribes and fight against the U.S. that way. There was a very diverse experience of African Americans, entrepreneurs, towns that were built that were actually destroyed, you know, that were destroyed illegally, that went very unconstitutionally or whatnot. And, you know, when you go into that, it really, I think the framework is to give a more full or more holistic perspective of what it means to be an American, what it means to move forward, and also what methodologies we can utilize to create the best and the highest levels of productivity amongst our students.
And you mentioned that, especially for Black American youth, knowing their heritage is vitally important. And I guess what I'm wondering is, like, what are the biggest benefits of that? I mean, there's the obvious one of revealing history that up until now is not as widely disseminated. But even just on a personal level, like, what have you seen? What kinds of effects can this have? Not just for maybe kids in a particular school, but just on a macro level, for especially as we have a new generation of Black American youth that are very much passionate about this sort of thing.
What you're going to see is I've seen, and you know, I'm reading this book, Multicultural Education by James A. Banks. You're going to see kids become more excited about education, about the process of learning, which will translate to other parts of their education. Because, you know, if you're saying, hey, this is something I really want to know. Hey, I do want to know about myself. Hey, this is going to help with my self-development. Then you're going to want to study more. You're going to want to learn more. You're going to have a different attitude towards education.
And now you've also applied this in prison populations too. What has that experience been like?
Really, that's been the most heartwarming experience, because you got youth who are not, you know, like, who have been kind of thrown away by society, or not have not a lot of times had the same resources other students may have had. And when they're getting them, or getting services that are really tailored culturally specifically for them, because I work with a lot of the African American culture groups, those kids, I've seen them go into tears. I've seen, you know, just a renewed sense of hope in their eyes.
Mm-hmm. It seems like that would hold some real implications when we talk about things like directionlessness, if you will, that if you have a generation of Black youth that are raised, we hear about the school to prison pipeline, that it's almost like they think, I'm on just a one track destiny here for the slammer. But this seems like it would offer them another way to approach themselves, to think that not only do I come from a rich history of societies and cultures and all these different things, what kinds of inspiration do you think there is for almost like breaking with expectations, breaking with the system, if you will, if I can put my anarchist hat on, but you know, just something along the lines of, this is another way that the predominant narrative doesn't show me. How much of that do you think is embedded in the work that you do?
That's huge. That's actually that was probably one of the roots of why I studied so hard. I saw how society framed Black men, and I said, that's not who I want to be. And so I started searching for ways or examples of us throughout history. You know, when you think about studying Mansa Musa, when you think about studying all these various different richer, powerful characters, then you start saying, oh, okay, cool, this is who I want to be, or this is how I want to be.
And I'm wondering how this intersects with some of the rises of this this political activism that we've seen. Because you have things like Black Lives Matter really rising, along with a number of other movements in local and regional circles. And there are those who coin it as like it's kind of like the new wave of the mid-20th century civil rights era type of thing. Well, I do think about the mid-20th century, and I think about the figures and the movements associated with that. And we do remember that, going back to the Black church, that did play a pivotal role as an organizing tool, beyond just the fact that it produces people like the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but also is that it's a lot easier to get a lot of folks in one place if you know they're going to show up there every Sunday anyhow. So as these different liberation movements are lighting up, what kind of role can something like this play? Maybe not necessarily, again, in terms of winning converts, but this philosophy, the lessons embedded within, the new inspired confidence that this kind of education can really provide. Just from your point of view as someone really passionate about these things, where do you see these things intersect, and what does the future look like for that?
So here's the thing. A lot of times when I do work in schools and stuff, I don't, you know, I'm very much, I'm a supportive separation from religion and state, you know? So even in the education system, right? I'll teach it as folklore, like whenever I do want to talk about Risha. But for the most part, what I'm getting at is the root of, hey, being African or having that legacy, knowing your root, knowing your legacy outside of what's been taught, like as far as, or what's been omitted from history, is extremely important. And so when I teach it from that framework of just self-determination, self-sufficiency, encouraging that, students really get encouraged. And I see it gives them a new hope.
Mm-hmm. And taking this into the wider global perspective, because we've talked about that this stigma seems to exist, not just on the continent. I can't speak to Brazil as much. I just am not as familiar with the history of that down there. If you are, definitely jump in. How important is it going to be to connect in that way? Because there is the sense of Pan-Africanism. This is something that gets thrown around quite a bit. And I know different folks feel different kinds of ways about that. But one of the things that I've often heard levied is, if you look at someone like, you know, Gerald Horn has talked about this, the historian, so have many others, that especially in recent years, there has been a tendency for Black American activist groups to not be as engaged with the wider world. And that sometimes can work against them, in the sense that a lot of times exterior pressure does help to crush oppressive structures. And if we want to look at the other way that goes, look at apartheid. Mm-hmm. South Africa is one example of that. So looking at this kind of communication that can happen between Black Americans, folks on the continent, how do these spiritual practices, how do they act as a medium for that, if that makes sense?
I think at the root of it is self-determination. And honestly, I think that when we look at capitalism, right, pull yourself up by your bootstrap, you know, work hard. Hey, you can have a piece of the American pie too. Hey, free market, do your business, create an economy within the economy that helps the other economy. I think, you know, African Americans adopting that self-determination, self-sufficiency mindset, even when it goes down to religion, is probably, quote unquote, now this will be fun, can be argued to fall in line with quote unquote American values anyway. You know, when people talk about, hey, you know, actually it was very un-American for, or, you know, we can even look at it because the goal of African American when we first came to this country was not to participate in capitalism. It was to actually be this, to be the work labor of capitalism, but not to be able to participate in a way where we get any of that wealth for ourselves. And in order to build communities where you can get some of that wealth, that level of self-determination, self-sufficiency, I also look into yourself as, hey, I control my destiny, which also I would argue goes to Christianity and goes to the concept of how you move, how you raise your family, how you worship, right? Instead of saying, you know, looking to other people to help you out or looking to other people to, like, guide you towards this, that's us falling in line with saying, hey, okay, cool. We're American in this country. We're going to move in the way that we need to move, in the way that produces us the highest levels of productivity, which, as we've seen, there's evidence that's shown there's a whole movement of multicultural education. When youth are studying themselves, it makes it easier for them to look at the world in a critical, you know, context. When youth see education that reflects who they are, then they're able to, you know, get that A in biology or chemistry. So all I'm saying is really for us to take an approach in which Africanisms, African Americanisms, were at the forefront of that, and figure out how do we develop a subculture of economic and social empowerment, which spreads throughout the community.
Mm-hmm. I also want to ask about, in this liberation struggle, the role of Black women in particular. Because it ain't a secret that even in some of the most celebrated Black movement organizations, there still can be a lot of misogynoir that runs through them. What place do Black women have in this? And in particular, how does something like IFA really seek to empower that Black feminine?
So I'll just straight up say, you know, there's a different movement, but there's a difference between womanism and feminism. I tell women all the time who get into Ifa, I say, hey, if you're, you know, feminism actually doesn't really have a strong role in African spiritual beliefs. And that sounds like really like, oh my gosh, what is he saying, right? In his modern society. Really, you know, a lot of the work that feminism has done, and I'm not talking about in white society, in the African American society, the community, I mean, there's been, that's why, well, first of all, has been, a lot of scholars have argued detrimental. And I know this is something that, I mean, a lot of people might not be open in saying, but that's why feminists such as, you know, such as Angela Davis have said, you know, and others said, hey, we're going to create a subgroup, which is womanism. Because the issues that white women have with their men are actually very different than the issues that black women have with their men. Mm-hmm. You know, I was reading an article, or actually listening to a documentary, and they were talking about the marriage rate in the black community pre even welfare and whatnot like that in the 50s was actually slightly higher than that of the white community. That us working together in the black community, it was to the point where they banned us from having marriages, and we still developed systems such as jumping the broom to consummate our marriages and say, hey, this is real. We're going to be married. So the African American, even right after slavery, the black men and black women came together and said, okay, cool, you're good at this, I'm good at this. Let's go ahead and build and develop towns like Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was actually in Oklahoma and heard about a lot of black woman millionaires in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And this is in the black American community.
And so just for listeners who may not be aware, just as a quick detour, we're talking about the Black Wall Street in particular, right?
Yes.
Yeah, just for folks who may not be aware, just give a brief synopsis on what that was.
Yeah, okay. So basically Black Wall Street happened in Greenwood, Oklahoma, in Tulsa, and the area was Greenwood. And that's basically where a lot of African Americans, we came together right after slavery and built a town that had banks, that had its own airport, and whatnot like that. And actually, a white woman claimed that a black man harassed her, which was actually proved false. And the black people, of course, you know, black men actually went to the white town where he was arrested and said, no, nobody's getting hung today. It was about 10 black men who came together in a crowd full of about 500 whites with their guns and said, you're not going to hang him, right? And so actually there was a huge, and when he was released, the white town, some of the agents in that came down and they were fighting, you know, with their guns. But the black, one of the things that's not talked about, I was just in Tulsa, Oklahoma, studying that, is a lot of those people who were living in Tulsa, Oklahoma, were either veterans or their parents fought in, like, the Civil War, right? So you're having these black men who actually had guns and who were actually able to defend their town to the point where, you know, it was a standstill. It wasn't until the U.S. government launched an airstrike bombing Tulsa, Oklahoma.
That's right.
That Tulsa, Oklahoma became massacred. So I think
actually that's actually the first time that bombs have ever been used on American soil is the Tulsa bombing.
Yeah. On Tulsa, because and destroying that black wealth. There were towns like that across the entire United States too. So I don't want us to only think that only Oklahoma. No, there was economic, you know, development movements across the United States and where black men and black women work together. See what we have now, and that's why I say feminism, you know, when we look at various societies and what that means for different culture groups, because we all have very different history. When we talk about the oppressive man or the oppressive male structures or of capitalism or whatnot, right? Black men and black women interacted and have tried to engage in capitalism. And there have been movements like Tulsa, Oklahoma, that have intentionally destroyed black people's engaging in the system of capitalism. to the point where now we see also, like, when we look in the black community now, right, even in the 50s, like, black men, it was very much pushed education and education and business. Now what you see being pushed in is sports, entertainment, some sort of musical talent, right? And I know I'm a drummer, but at the same time too, you know, I still am completely against saying that black children's only contribution to society is going to be entertainment or sports. Mm-hmm. You know, and so what you see now is, you know, a lot of times, you know, and that's why you see this kind of movement happen, this conflict between even amongst a lot of black feminists and white feminists, because what happens is, okay, hey, you know, when white feminism happened or whatnot, right, you actually had this structure of, okay, these white males who might have had this amount of wealth or this money. In our community, you know, black boys are reading at, like, the average black boys, you know, they're reading at elementary school level, even if they're in high school. The prison that most black, you know, if we look at the numbers of people who are getting arrested, some women will say, oh, well, black women are, numbers are rising. They may be rising, but they're still not at the level that black males are incarcerated. You have, you know, so you have these huge education disparity gaps. Well, actually, societally, black women make more money on average than black men. And so a lot of the, you know, so when we talk about the structures of feminism now, right? And all you have to do really is look at, you can look at podcasts, YouTube, you can look at articles where a lot of black women are saying, hey, you know, when I have all this education, it's hard for me to find a mate who makes equal or more than I make because of that systemic racism, right? And so what you're getting right now is when people talk about misogynoir, when they're talking about, you know, feminism and whatnot like that, or other subjects in the black community, what you're getting to is also, you know, this kind of, you're getting this dialectic where, okay, yes, the larger community, and yet, you know, you see this stuff, or even within, you know, on micro levels in the African-American community, right? But the statistics still say that economically and socially, we're actually one of the few societies in America where actually the men are doing far less. I don't want to say good, but yes, good as far as productivity than the woman, due to a lot of that systematic racism. So racism always, I would say that racism is definitely America's baby. It's America's, like, oil and gas, like what they've run on for so long. And when you throw in racism, you never get it. It always, it always complicates the situation. It's not, it no longer turns into, okay, well, these men against these women, as much as, hey, what's going on to the structure? Okay, we're, you know, because at the end of the day, even society, I think it was Switzerland. Was it Switzerland? One European nation, they actually have done some of the best work. And I'm actually making sure that, you know, like, as far as equal access, gender-wise, right? And they recognize that because, you know, there is that biological factor of sometimes women will be like, hey, okay, well, I do want to take time off for working because when I have children, or actually I kind of would like to kind of be with the children and whatnot, like that, right? You started seeing that there was a disparity in the fields that they started to choose. Not the pay, but the fields. And so you see that, that dynamic happening, and then, you know, one and then so it gets to a point where it's like, oh wait, hold up, is this as much, does this have a lot to do with does this have as much to do with racism, I mean not racism, but sexism, or does it have to also do, like, with gender pay or whatever like that, as much as certain aspects of, like, okay, cool, fields that people are going to get into to for, like, you know, for their goals for their families or for their future, right? And so when you look at even within the African-American community, right, now you're getting a lot of, like, this conversation happening where even women are saying, hey, we actually want our, you know, we want to be comfortable when we have get married and get pregnant or whatnot, right? We don't want to have to work while we're pregnant. So we actually want our men to be pushed into these fields that are making more money. Right. And but then at the same time, too, there's that whole dynamic of, like, oh, but misogyny and this. Right. So it's kind of like now there's these conversations that are happening between black men and black women where we're saying, hey, we need to divest ourselves from what the creator white society has been doing. and talk about what does feminism or what does womanism mean in the Black community? Does it mean actually, because, you know, does it mean that actually men have not valued, and that's all, I think a larger thing, but even with feminism, have not valued the role or even certain things, sacrifices that women make in order to push forward the family, which in indigenous African culture was never a thing. That's why we had woman goddesses that we worshiped. And we said, oh gosh, she's the goddess of fertility. She's the goddess of childbirth. So that was actually, that was elevated. You know, that was an elevated role to actually say, hey, I actually do this, or I'm actually a mother, or I'm this, right? And so when I think one of the issues and going on is the fact that in our society, this is where we'll believe the patriarchy happens. The role of woman within even raising the family or within the nurturer was completely discounted. So now you're having like a lot of women saying, hey, cool, I'm doing this, is this. So I should definitely receive these kind of accolades. And some of the men are saying, okay, you're doing this, is this. And in our community, we're saying we don't really like, unless, you know, when it comes to dating dynamics, yes, but this doesn't really, you know, a lot of times, you know, you will have some men who'll be, oh, okay, this is great. But a lot of there's also a lot of complaints, as you know, that I've heard personally of women saying, oh gosh, I wish I had someone who could actually help me when I'm doing this, or I wish I didn't have to carry on this much as well. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's kind of like, you know, I really, when I see moving forward in this movement, is African Americans divesting themselves from a European structure of the duality between masculinity and femininity, and going to saying, okay, what's a more indigenous approach that works best for both of us?
Mm-hmm. And something that you said in there that I think that makes me think about is, I don't know if you're familiar with the podcast Side Hustle Pro. It's hosted by Nikayla Matthews of Colme, and the whole premise of it, it's a great show. I encourage all our listeners to check it out. She interviews women who now run businesses. They're entrepreneurs, Black women, who really just started as side hustles. And there's tons of them. I mean, I don't even know how long she's been going. It's been going on for years, right? She's been on like Today and like TED and like all of them. Right. And this strikes me as what you're saying, that as there is more of an impulse to divest and disconnect from a dominant structure, right, and to really contest that structure. Of course, you can do that all day. You still got to pay your bills, right? The light's only going to stay on so long. You can't always keep that open with fervor. Yeah. So this culture that seems to have arisen of the side hustle. And I mean, nowadays, I mean, there's that's a common thing. There's a lot of white folks who've adopted it too, but it really seems to have its spirit in this Black female entrepreneurial spirit that you've just talked to. Like, I don't think it's an accident that something like Side Hustle Pro can go on for however many years and still come up with tons of new guests to interview about, this is how I got started, I did this as a hobby, or I did this out of necessity. Definitely seems to be a connection there.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, and here's the thing. Even in Africa, you know, the marketplace was controlled by women. Mm-hmm. Selling and stuff like that. So that's why I say, like, we've never, like, we got to really look at, when we think about what feminism or what womanism means in our collective, what does that mean actually in our collective? Because, you know, as you know, mentioned, economic pursuits was never seen as something that was an intimidating factor by African, you know, by African peoples. But then they also had very strong priorities of saying, hey, okay, cool, children. Okay, cool, the husband has this role and stuff like that. So as we even discuss what that means for us now in this modern epoch, it's really important to, like, kind of divest ourselves from the struggles of the dominant society and look specifically at our struggles.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one last thing I want to touch on before we wrap up here, and that is the future of the Hawk Foundation, of this type of education, and what you really expect from it. We're going to make that our last segment coming up here in a second. This is World Beat with George Collins. Stick with us. Be right back. Welcome back to World Beat. I am George Collins. We've been sitting here with Javon Bird, ethnomusicologist and serial entrepreneur. If you ain't gotten caught up in the last few segments, I would do that before getting here. This is our final stretch. Javon, we've covered a lot, and I always like to look to the future in our last stretches of these interviews right here. I remember when we sat down, I guess it was a couple of years ago now, as the Hawk Foundation was really starting to get going. You were getting some of your first contracts at the time and some of your first grants. And at the time, you said that you really dreamt of every child across the country being able to benefit from this kind of education. I want to know what your goals are for the Hawk Foundation and Awodi Drummond, how those have changed, how you've adapted to the pandemic. Obviously, can't exactly bring in a drum for a big old circle when COVID-19 is shredding the country. What are your thoughts? What are your projections, your short-term goals, your long-term goals? What does the future look like?
So we've done, like I said, in-state contracting on both levels in the schools and also juvenile detention centers. We're definitely growing our school hold and going to different districts. But we're also, you know, I think the next step is federal, going on a federal level, getting these programs implemented federally so that they are felt statewide. So right now, I think that's where we're going right now. Statewide, we're growing still a little bit more. But yes, the federal level is where we're definitely looking to reach.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing, I hate to bring this up because I think it's really overblown, but I do think that we need to touch on it at least a little bit. In the past couple of years, there's been all this panic about, you know, critical race theory, right? Which, I mean, I think that's really an online thing, if I'm going to be honest with you. I look at a lot of polling, like, you know, this was brought up in the Virginia governor's race. I don't know how closely you followed that, but one of the things that was really blamed when that went the Republican way was that there was all this panic about CRT, and this is what people really focused on. It's like, you look at exit polling, 2% of people even know what the hell that is. And like less than a fraction of that even care about it. But I still feel that we need to touch on it because when we are talking about something at the federal level, there are definitely going to be detractors. There are going to be people who look at this and say, why are we teaching this? Why are we telling white kids they're racist? You know, we've heard all these things like that. And however ridiculous we might feel them, the bottom line is there is a segment for whom that seems to resonate, and there are definitely politicians looking to capitalize on that. What is your response when people bring up things like that?
I actually, while there might be certain similarities between what I teach, I don't think I teach critical race theory. Some of the frameworks that I have seen being taught go along with, you know, teaching white people about maybe biases or racism that they may have within some historical event and whatnot to kind of show that more. But I think that for me personally, I always tell, this is how I always kind of get even a lot of my white parents to kind of calm down. I say, I'm not teaching critical race theory. I'm teaching American history. Mm-hmm. Pre-Civil War America, they had Maroons who fought against slavery. We all know that, hey, there were black towns that were destroyed unconstitutionally. If you're truly an American and you believe in American values, then you're going to be along with me and saying, hey, this is unfair and this needs to be taught so we don't repeat this again. And so that we understand why certain communities are in the positions that they are in and that they weren't given an equal chance to participate in American capitalism. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the structure of what I do, I keep it very neutral. And all I do is I just talk about facts that have happened in American soil that have happened. And when I go to Africa, when I write, you know, that's multicultural education in general. So it's still not critical race theory. I consider it multicultural education. And maybe it has some of the same effects that critical race theory does have. But at the same time, I say that, hey, my main objective is to actually just supply you history in an unbiased perspective and you take it from where it is, right? I definitely talk about the African-American experience, but I don't tell people how they should feel or whatnot. You know, I think most human beings, though, when they figure out that towns were destroyed just because of the fact that they were wealthy and they were successful in interacting with capitalism, most human beings are going to feel some sort of way about that and feel that that was an injustice and that America was wrong for letting that happen. You know, but I don't have to tell white kids that, hey, you know, you were taught to be racist your whole entire life. All I got to do is give them facts and history, and people make their own decisions.
You know, it's a great point. If you look at, you know, we brought up the example of Tulsa and the many other entrepreneurial cities that were predominantly black, and even the most diehard Friedman-loving market fundamentalist. I mean, if you were to say to them, okay, why was Tulsa bombed? Because, like you just said, there were black people engaging in capitalism. Well, you can't really argue against that, can you? I mean, that's...
Look, I don't care if you're a dude from, like, some random country area that's just, like,
the Confederate flag
on your window, right? When I explain it that way, that makes them start to crack a little bit, like, oh... Wait, they were just good American capitalists. Right.
They were bombed
due to racism. Oh, and that's why I say, like, I always tell people all the time, I said, I don't teach critical race theory. I just teach American history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I believe, and a lot of white children will listen to what I'm saying. And I'm not saying that they're racist or that they're trying to be racist, but they'll look at it and be like, hey, mom, dad, this is unfair that this happened to this group of people.
That's it.
I don't have to be biased, because when you're on the side of truth, you know, things just come to light.
Well, it makes me think of this whole idea of, like, meeting people where they are and talking in language that they can understand, which is exactly what you've just outlined. And it's something that I feel like many on the left forget, is that yes, there is, it's real nice to, like, go real deep on a lot of theory and stuff in a seminar building, right? I mean, I went to school down Olympia. I was in plenty of those. But we often forget that's a very siloed place. And even among other white people, even if you take that into it. Well, actually, there was an analogy. Who was it? Damn, I can't remember. I'll have to find out so I can give proper credit. But they were talking about how when it comes to a lot of stuff like this, if you think about like doctors, right? The way the doctors talk to each other, it's real different from how they talk to a patient, right? Mm-hmm. Because when they're talking to each other, they're going to be using jargon and all these things that you'd have to look into, like, a medical encyclopedia if you want to figure out what the hell that means. But they don't come and say that to you when you're sitting there on the table and asking for why my back still hurts after all this time. And to me, I feel like there's a lot of folks, especially on the left, who have yet to bridge that gap, where it seems almost like terms are just thrown around in a way to be condescending. It's like, well, if you don't get this, and even when people ask genuine questions, like, I don't know what this means. Like, what is that? Can you explain it to me? And there's a tendency just to browbeat them and just go, how the hell do you not know what this means? You know, even though you didn't go to some Ivy League ivory tower.
Thank you.
So that to me, I mean, what you're talking about is bridging that gap where, when you do start talking to someone who wears a t-shirt of the Godsden flag or whatever. But if you frame it in the sense of, do you think that black folks should be allowed to be capitalists? Yes or no? Yeah. Well, if they're real big on it, that ain't a hard question.
Yeah, most that's what I said. I said, you know, you get me in front of some Republicans and I have them still not being able to really say, not really able to argue with my points, because I keep them very neutral. I'm like, hey, these were hardworking American capitalists who had their towns bombed for no reason. Even if there was one individual who accosted one lady, why did the American government team up with this mob and bomb this town? I don't care how conservative you are, you're going to say, hey, that was wrong. I don't care if you're the most conservative Christian person, you're going to say that was unchristian. And that's what I say. I say all the time, you know, I believe that a lot of the left, you know, really moves in a fashion that is very classist in itself. It's, hey, if you don't hold these certain ideas, or if you don't talk in this certain way, then you're not smart. But actually, honestly, that class was really developed by capitalistic efforts. You know, you need Billy Bob, who's working in the factory, to support the intellectual scholar who's studying at the Ivy League, or whatnot. And I think that sometimes, like, that's one of the issues in our country. We're kind of moving past understanding how interconnected we all are. And that it's, you know, you can talk about Billy Bob, but actually you should try to reason with Billy Bob too.
Mm-hmm. It, yeah. It makes me think there's this quiz online. Was it online or was it? I'll have to look into where it was. But it was more or less a thing of, like, how wide or blue collar are you?
Yeah.
In terms of, like, it'll give you a list of prompts and you answer them according to what it makes you think of, right? So, like, the quietest example from that is, like, if I say Scranton, what do you think of? And you're either going to think of Branson. If I say Branson, right, what do you think of? And for a lot of folks, they might think, hey, Richard Branson, right? You know, the big British billionaire, whatever. Mm-hmm. Some other folks might say the Branson plant down in Missouri, right? Which is a huge, mm-hmm. like, famous manufacturing hub. And mm-hmm. so depending on how you answer one way or another depends on your level of, I shouldn't say level of education because that doesn't sound right, but how immersed in the typical educational structure you really are. Right. And what you pointed out, I think, becomes a really pivotal thing, not just for the political future of the country, because that, of course, has all kinds of political economy implications, but also what you're talking about in terms of when we do take these education programs to a federal level, and regardless of who the audience is, that, yeah, there's a way of speaking that very much shuts out a huge faction of the audience sometimes. And if that's not bridged, I think you got to ask, how effective is that education program, really?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And that's my biggest concern. I'm very much into just saying, hey, I'm just pursuing truth, not an idea. You know, and the truth of it does make it an idea, like of true equity. True equity, the reason why a lot of this history was not talked about in the schools was because it was unconstitutional. It did go against the values of Americanism. Now, if there's a white dude who says, yeah, okay, I know that was racist, but I don't care. At least not like that, then, you know, we have nothing to talk about. But at the same time, most, you know, he's a fascist, but most of the time, if I can tell you history and it's true that this has been done to this group of people, even if you were, you know, right, left, conservative, whatnot, you're still going to have a certain level of concern and be like, oh, that was done? That's wrong.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if nothing else, you got to think, look, they did it to one group at some point. Well, how long before that comes for you?
Yep. That's why a lot of lower class, you know, white families are complaining about what's going on in America right now. They're like, hey, hold up, America, you know, effed over this group of people. Now they're effing us over, too.
Yeah, well, like the journalist Charlie the Duff once said, right, you know, the inner city and the trailer park, they're a lot closer together than the trailer park and the ivory tower.
Thank you. Exactly.
Because they're the ones who get beers together on Friday night.
Exactly.
One more question that I've also been thinking about, and turning back to Black Americans in particular. I mentioned a little bit ago, kind of in passing, that the whole idea of something like Pan-Africanism can get a little bit dicey, depending on who you talk to. And even if we don't want to use the term for that, because that tends to be applying more to, like, politics and social issues in particular. But I've heard some segments talk about how when we're talking about reconnecting with African values. Now, one of the things that I think the 1619 Project pointed out, and I believe I was listening to an interview with the author when they said this, is you look at Black Americans who fly the American flag in their front yard. Some folks might think, why the hell would they do that? But what this person pointed out, it's actually not that counterintuitive, because exactly like you've explained a couple segments ago, there are so many practices, spiritual and secular, that had to be homegrown on the American continent because people were rendered from whatever it was that they came
from. You.
And in that way, setting aside, of course, indigenous Americans and that whole genocide, when people look at what is the, quote, American culture, the true American culture, It's got to be the one that came up here, and really the only one that can qualify is that created by Black Americans, which could also offer an explanation for why is it that anything that comes out of Black America is deemed cool, right? Why do we like Black culture but not Black people? These are all questions that really stem from that. I think what that can also produce, and in my experience, is there are folks who then will say, either we don't need anything that comes from the continent, or why would we even explore that because we've grown something ourselves? What's the value in that? What's your response to something like that?
So here's the thing. I get it. After slavery, like my granddaddy did my history, and I realized we've been fighting in all the wars in America, right? My dad lived in Germany for a little bit because my granddaddy fought in World War II, and all it was just all kinds of stuff that was going on, right? So you see, like, I do believe that Black Americans definitely have a right to, you know, if I see a Black American with a flag in front of his house, I don't think, oh, why would he do that? I'm like, yeah, because he's actually probably the most American. Even despite how this country treats him with everyday racism, he still believes in what America can be, and he fights for America. You know, so I'm definitely always, you know, I don't see anything wrong with a Black man putting a flag above his house, especially, you know, even with me. I'm like, I don't think I would do it, but I mean, even if I did, it would be like, shoot, my dad, my grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather fought for America. And, you know, that's just who we are. Right. And so I understand certain Black Americans, also some who might study African culture as a mere dilettante, might think, oh, well, they sold us, so why do we need to look to them? We should look to ourselves. I understand that completely, too. Right. This is what I believe in, though. I believe in America, and you know, America also does this a lot, too, just in our research system. Go into different cultures. And take in the best of that culture, implement in the best of what you have, and creating something new. I don't believe that African Americans should go back to living 100% African lifestyle. You know, I mean, I honestly, even though, like, yes, I'm very pro-Black, very pro, you know, African indigenous culture, I also understand that you have to, I also understand that Yoruba culture has gone through many cultural changes. Because there was developments that happened. There have been developments that have happened now. I'm an African American, so I need to understand what those changes mean for myself too. So I believe that African Americans who do believe that, hey, there's no need to go back, I just question them and I say, well, maybe you lack imagination though, because there are still some things that the continent has to offer to us. I'm not saying that you have to go back to saying that you're an African, you know, because you might just say, hey, I'm an American, but you should still take the best of what your indigenous culture has to offer to you as you move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wise words there. And I think especially for that issue, there's a great episode of The Grapevine for folks that are familiar with that. It's a series on YouTube that does roundtable discussions on a number of different topics. They did a great series about, I think, 5 or 6 years ago, talking about this divide between African immigrants to the United States and African Americans. They did one segment from the African perspective, one from the African American perspective, and then a third one when they brought them together with some Caribbean folks too. So definitely recommend that folks check that out. Javon, you've been very generous with your time, and thank you very much. Anything you want to add before we wrap up here?
Yep. If you want to learn more about the education efforts of the Hawk Foundation, please look up hfeducation.org. Again, hfeducation.org. We also have, if you want to contribute or donate, then on the page you'll see Donate Now link. Just click on that. And yeah, anybody's welcome to go ahead and help support our cause.
And anyone who wants to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
You can go to Javon, Javoen, at hfeducation.org. Also on the website, you have an info.education.org. You can connect to us through there.
Javon Bird, thank you so much for joining World Beat.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And thank you all you for tuning in. We'll be back on the next one with another great interview for you. I'm George Collins, signing off. Ciao, baby. Girl.
way. Don't you in a special way? I don't know why Cupid's arrow wish up my way. But hey girl, I'm gonna tell you how I feel today. First day we was talking, you was telling me you was walking away from your corporate. You got plans for bigger shit, better shit. I just listened, you were saucy with your etiquette. I believe you when you said you had a better fit. Couldn't help it, I was staring just a little bit, girl. It be hella lit how you invite me in your world. When I'm in those guts, I go nuts like a squirrel. Is you who I think about? Be with, yeah. So what would you think about? We see what's the secret. True love says it's perfect, but only if I decline. So baby, won't you be mine? Think about it, yeah. I rip that, flip that girl, I know it's lie. I hit that, get that girl, I know it's lie. I did that girl, I know it's lie. I lick that, flick that girl, I know it's right. Hey girl, you're so fine, I don't know what to say.
I don't know what to say.
And hey girl, I really want you in a special way.
Want you in a special way.
I don't know why Cupid's arrow went shot my way. But hey girl, I'm gonna tell you how I feel today.
Tell you how I feel today.
What to say?
I don't know what to say.
And hey girl, I really want you in a special way.
Want you in a special way.
I don't know why Cupid's arrow went shot my way. But hey girl, I'm gonna tell you how I feel today.
Tell you how